Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men in the middle of America talk about politics and current events. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
And Brandon, do we have anything to talk about this week?
I think we have one news item to talk about, and only one.
Pretty slow week, you know, right. Driving over here. It's like, I don't know if Brandon and I could fill an hour this week. We're recording this pod Friday evening. So I think this was the week to wait until Friday, simply because there's so much happening. At least now we have the full week in behind us for the Kavanaugh story that we can talk about at least some conclusions that got reached, what's going to happen next week, and just kind of look back at, again, one of the most bizarre weeks in politics, really, in the history of the United States.
Right. Well, and uncharted territory in terms of where this nomination headed and the outcome. I mean, we're now at a point, and we'll talk about what happened within the last several hours, but this is new. So the timeline from here into the next several days is going to be really interesting.
So just where we're at right now. So Jeff Flake came out in committee. He voted to get him out of committee, but I believe he said, I will not vote to confirm without the FBI
investigation.
Doing an investigation.
Correct.
And that gave the cover to Murkowski and Collins, and they all huddled up in McConnell's office, and they basically said, hey, we're not going to do this either. We're not going to vote to confirm him without at least some sort of FBI touch point on some of these allegations. And I saw Trump now has said he is ordering the FBI to reopen the background investigation into Kavanaugh.
Right. And you know, it was interesting because watching the hearings today and the commentary after Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, Democrat, spoke and I think was very reasonable and pointed about the need to, you know, resolve the issue of not having the FBI investigation. As he walked out after that, Senator Flake went up to him and they were speaking. And immediately I started thinking, you know, I think that, you know, Senator Flake is, you know, having second thoughts here about rushing the vote. And then, you know, and then he was also, Senator Flake was also confronted by two women as well. And so you can look at those events and how that impacted where he is now and being able. And it's, again, the Senate is very interesting that way because one person, unlike the House, one person can hold a lot of power.
Yeah.
And we saw that with Senator Flake.
And I think for Democrats, there was a, we like Flake. Flake gives a great speech. Were you ever going to do anything? And I think this was the moment where he finally decided, I've got to do something more than just give an eloquent speech on the floor of the Senate about what's happening. I think the two women who confronted him in the elevator, one said, I believe she was raped like 13 years ago. And at some point during this exchange, I think she actually reaches into the elevator, stops the door, looks at Flake and says, don't you look away from me. And Flake was pretty shaken up after yesterday. You could tell he was really hand-wringing over this. He was really putting some thought into it. I think between Coons and that encounter, he realized to the depth that people are this is really tearing us apart in a lot of ways. And he decided to exercise that power that you talk about that one senator can have and say, we've got to put a slowdown to this and we cannot vote on this this weekend.
Right. And we knew going along, if there was any senator that was going to do this, it would be somebody like Senator Flake, Senator Collins, or Senator Murkowski, because that's really, those are the senators that have shown independence that are, you know, split from the party, you know, when they feel necessary. I think this also does a great deal of service to the country as a whole and to the Republicans, because I think that had this nomination been rushed through a vote, this would have been a cloud hanging over Kavanaugh. I mean, for, you know, the entirety of his tenure, and I think it would have definitely just kind of, I mean, completely destroyed the Republican brand heading into the fall. And so again, you know, I don't think there's any expectation that we're going to have a complete resolution, but we're going to have clarity. The FBI investigation will hopefully provide clarity, and there will, you know, and more evidence that there wasn't any stones left unturned and the due diligence was done, because we didn't have that. And there would always be that claim that there was no due diligence and this was a rush process and what could have been brought to light that wasn't. Yeah.
So there's so much going on. Maybe let's just first focus on the hearing yesterday. I watched all of it. I know you watched the majority of it. That was, after Dr. Ford got done, it's like, well, this is over.
It was very riveting testimony. Absolutely. And I don't know how anybody could walk away with it not believing that she was credible and that she was poised and that something happened to her, that she was assaulted. That became very clear.
Nobody can walk away with that and said that woman was not traumatized by something.
Right.
And the amount of empathy that you feel for her is extremely high. And I think people like Ben Sasse and Flake, I think you could see that in them listening to her testimony. I think it was a genius move on the Republicans' part not to let the senators directly talk to Dr. Ford. While that woman and the mechanism,
the prosecutor,
those 5-minute increments was choppy.
Yeah.
Orrin Hatch, when asked about Dr. Ford, called her attractive and pleasant.
Oh, I did not hear that. I missed that.
That is exactly why you do not let the senator from Utah talk to the sexual assault victim.
True. I did read some commentary that some of the senators felt like the prosecutor wasn't as effective for them, which I could understand. She's not a political person. She's a prosecutor.
And that format where every 5 minutes they were like,
that made it very difficult. Awful. Yeah, because
she couldn't do anything.
Yeah, well, and I think for everybody involved, because even, you know, Dr. Ford would, you know, start getting into a rhythm, and then she could have continued because of the format and the questions.
So with that, when that opened, first off, I owe Senator Orrin Hatch an apology. I've been saying for weeks he's 88, he's 84. My bad. So that opened.
He's a spring chicken. Come on.
He is. That opened, that hearing opened with the 85-year-old Chuck Grassley talking about the rules for conducting an inquiry on sexual assault, followed by the 86-year-old Diane Feinstein chiming in as well. It looked like your grandma and grandpa are going to debate they're going to conduct this sexual assault or this type of inquiry.
Well, and if you didn't know any better, it would have looked like, you know, if you're an outside person looking in, that this was being conducted in a senior living facility.
Absolutely. So if there was ever a picture for age requirement and term limits, there it was.
Right.
I mean, it was right in front of you. How in the world do these two people lead this process?
And not just age limits and term requirements in Congress, but also the Supreme Court. I can't tell you how many people have told me that within the last couple of days, saying that it's crazy that we have lifetime appointments and you can be on the court at 88, 90, 95 years old and be, you know, ruling on cases that impact the entire country when we know that your mental faculties are not where they are at that age.
Just hearing Grassley sometimes trying to get through his introduction, trying to bring order to the room. It was difficult. But you have to realize he's 85 years old. I think that was a gripping visual. And we've talked about this a ton. That just kind of put that. If I'm a young voter, if you're 25, what are you waiting for? That should have said, oh, sweet Jesus, I didn't know that, you know, these two elderly people were the two basically involved with this. If you were not politically aware at all and you just caught those two on their opening image, that had to be your reaction of where did this old guy and where did this old gal come from and why are they leading this very important discussion?
Right. I mean, it was jarring. I think it's a jarring visual.
It is. And so we get through that, and Dr. Ford kind of starts off, and he had no idea what this prosecutor was going to do. And it was very apparent early on, I'm going to treat you with kid gloves. We are not going to talk about the specifics of what happened in that bedroom.
Well, and this was also a different situation for this prosecutor, because she's usually in the position of speaking up for victims of sexual assault, and here she was on the other side, you know. But, and again, I think there was some method to that madness, because, you know, not wanting to, you know, be insensitive in terms of the line of questioning. But you look at, and again, she didn't have much preparation. There was some criticism of the questions being disjointed and getting into territory that was irrelevant. Yep. And I think partially, A, she didn't have time to prepare, was kind of out of her element here. She didn't have a staff with her providing information and context, which I can understand. So, you know, in terms of being effective overall for the Republicans, I don't think it was, and I don't think they saw it that way either, which is why they did not have her continue to ask questions of Kavanaugh. They basically kind of pulled her.
They continued to Kavanaugh until Lindsey stood up.
Right.
Once Mr. Graham took over, it was, hey, I'm not letting him grab all of the highlights of this. I'm going to get mine. And then you got Cruz and other folks jumping in. But sticking with Ford for this section, it was a strange questioning.
It was.
The woman who was asking questions for the Republicans seemed to focus on very minute little details while the Democrats went big picture stuff.
And several of those details, there were no follow-up. So you didn't really see where those dots connected. And yeah. Part of that was the format, because this 5-minute increment. Yeah. And so, you know, it would be jumping to something else. And so it was just this back and forth, very disjointed. It was difficult to follow.
So she was credible. She was believable. But at the end of the day, she offered no evidence.
Right.
She couldn't corroborate anything. The witnesses that she said were there said they weren't there or they don't remember. It is only her story at the end of the day.
Correct. And that's a difficulty because all of the witnesses say they can't recall what happened. And the person
or wasn't there
or what or weren't there. And the person who probably has the most everybody wants to hear from, Mark Judge,
yeah.
Hasn't been interviewed. He gave, you know, that sworn, you know, written testimony, which was a very, you know, general statement and very brief, and that was it. But yeah, and that's what makes this so difficult, is that there, you know, there isn't any evidence, or is it anybody to witnesses to corroborate, and so you just have this out there. And at the same time, you have it in the context of somebody who's been elevated to the highest court of the land, and what does, you know, having these questions swirling around him, you know, and, so and the cases he may rule on.
Let's do this in the next 2 minutes. Let's you and I, as two reasonably intelligent, articulate human beings who just happen to be on other ends of the political spectrum, let's solve the problem of what is the burden of proof for a sexual misconduct or a sexual assault claim in a nomination.
Yes, because again, this is where people are getting confused, because this is not a trial. This is not a criminal proceeding.
This is basically a job interview.
Right. There, you don't have to have beyond a reasonable doubt.
Correct.
I mean, none of that factors in. This would be the same as if there was a, you know, background check run on an individual for a high-level executive position.
Yes.
That indicated potential questions of fraud or, you know, money mismanagement, and and the fact that maybe that wasn't resolved and that had to be taken into consideration in terms of them advancing.
That's a very valid point. And my wife, who's been an HR high-level professional for years, will just tell you, if any of this was happening in the context of a job interview, there's no way. You wouldn't hire this at all. But so the first point is, this is not a court.
Correct.
Beyond a reasonable doubt doesn't apply. The same standard of evidence doesn't apply. In sexual assault cases, there's very rarely corroborating evidence. A lot of times, this is going to boil down to he said, she said, and that's what we've got to go on. So what should the rules be? What is the... I am not comfortable saying this is the second week in a row. Help me with this word. Just because an accusation. it's Friday.
Okay.
Just because an
chalk it up to
say it for me.
Accusation?
Why don't you say acquisition? Because an accusation has been made. That is not enough to say the nomination is stopped.
I agree. I think we have to be very cautious because, it could set a very dangerous precedent if we just use accusations alone for the basis of derailing a nominee. But that's why this is such a gray area, because, again, there is no – what do you point to as objective criteria that you use to determine whether or not somebody can move forward?
So here's where it gets really weird. So I think if an accusation is made – and the person comes forth and puts their name on the record and is willing to testify, that is another level of degree that should be weighed in this decision.
Right.
if there are multiple
accusations.
Multiple accusations. What? Okay, what's a different word? Multiple charges.
There you go.
If there are multiple charges.
Allegations.
Thank you. I can say allegations. If there are, I don't know why I can't say that word. If there are multiple allegations, I think that has to come into it. And that there are multiple women who are willing to come forward. They are not anonymous. They sign on to a complaint. They are willing to testify in a situation where perjury applies. I think that has to go into it. But what do we keep stacking up until all of these allegations become something that now the country can live with, saying, okay, we're stopped. You flushed out of the process. We can't continue with you in this area.
I think ideally you would want witnesses or somebody to corroborate, yeah, you know, the claims or the circumstances of what happened. So even if you don't have, you know, a direct witness to what happened, you have witnesses that said, you know, this person told me at the time, or, you know, I saw the lead up to this. I saw, yeah, somebody engaging in behavior or exiting from a scene where this behavior was, yeah, occurring. You would want that to establish location, you know, that they were at that person was at the scene.
Yeah.
Because again, that's been the difficulty with this is, you know, because, yeah, he says he wasn't there at that party.
So let's say the one gal, her friend, Lenny or Laney or the one person, what if she comes out and says, hey, I was mistaken. I want to change my testimony. And now, yes, I was at that party. She was there. She went upstairs. I saw Mark Judge and Brett Kavanaugh go upstairs. I saw them come down and I saw her come down upset. Is that enough to corroborate her story?
I mean, you have a little bit of a credibility issue because you say, well, you, true, know, she said one thing, true, and now she's changing her story within, you know, that time frame. So I think it strengthens it. I don't know if that by itself is enough. I think you would still need the force of either another witness, yeah, or somebody else who can say that the victim spoke to them or related the situation that, yeah, happened. It's
that's what we're missing is what, yeah, are the rules of the game, right, for corroborating evidence? Because you're right, in a criminal investigation, that situation is probably not enough. In this type of situation, a lot of times that's all you're going to get. I mean, to me, the big thing is how do you stack up multiple allegations? How do you, because most people that do this behavior, it's a pattern. Yes, there are times that it happens one time, it never happens again, and that should not be dismissed or not treated serious. But a lot of times this is a pattern of behavior. How do we take the other allegations that have been made against Kavanaugh into this process?
Well, and ideally, I think you would want the FBI to vet those allegations to see if they rise to the same level. Because that's something we don't know. And, you know, and I think the latest allegation that appeared over the weekend, you know, there's a lot of questions about that. You know, there's nothing that's been confirmed or substantiated. Yeah. And that the alleged victim there hasn't even been interviewed. So, you know, you can't put all of these allegations aren't on parity, aren't on par.
I agree.
And so ideally we would want the FBI to vet them and understand, because again, if they, yeah, can provide some truth or, you know, be able to some extenuating evidence that we don't have, and then those allegations rise to the level, then that's, I think, additional consideration.
What do you think of the Michael Avenatti stuff?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's...
how do you parse that out?
I don't know. I think that's really difficult because there's credibility there because he went directly to the media and it became this whole, you know,
yeah,
kind
it's
of
Michael
cable.
Avenatti.
It is. And that's not saying that there's no truth there, but true, that's probably, and that's the most sensational so far of all, yes, the allegations, and saying that there were these basically gang rape rings, you know, that basically in the DC area.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, but I you would want that investigated too. You would want there to be a kind of complete.
If you investigate one, which is what they're talking about you now, you have to investigate all.
I feel like you do.
You
can't just let those hang out there. Because again, yeah, if any of those gain credibility, it adds credibility to Dr. Ford's know, accusations. So it's,
you are not married, correct, Brandon?
I'm not, no.
This was a good week not to be married, because there were a couple times that, you know, you had, were sitting there with your spouse and looking at each other, and you could just tell she was just getting more pissed and pissed as the day went on. I had this conversation with my wife, and I always preface this with her by saying, I know you're going to yell at me for this. I accept that. I understand that.
You're pretty used to that, right, Craig?
Just cannon shot away. It's okay. To me, the thing that really could have been flushed out that makes us more believable, there was a woman who came forward anonymously who said, I think it was her daughter and three other women were out with Kavanaugh. He got drunk. He was completely belligerent. He threw one of them up against a wall and did some sort of sexual pose or something. I don't know what the terminology is. It's like, now, wait a minute. That's something that he was at a bar. So people would be able to say, was he drunk? Was he not drunk? There was allegedly a victim and three women who allegedly said they saw it.
At least, if not other witnesses there that would have seen it.
Wouldn't that be the one that you say, hey, if we can get this, if you're willing to come out of anonymous and we can try to protect your name, that would be the one that I would be most interested, because this happened in 98. That's one that feels like there could actually be something there that crosses over.
It's more recent. There's less haziness as far as the memories go. And it's in a more public place than like a house party where, you know, people are doing their own thing and in different areas. And you might not have that awareness, or it's harder to be able to confirm.
So my last thing on that. So that I got through that part, you know, without being yelled at by the wife. The part that I got yelled at is, I hate, ladies, you're going to have to solve this problem. No more not coming forward under something like that. I get it. Coming forward, and I understand the reasons why women don't come forward. They're totally legitimate. Sexual assault and sexual harassment is a man's problem way more than a woman's problem. But if you don't grab this type of moment, and if you remain anonymous, if you're one of those three, and let's say that actually happened and you have a story to tell, if you don't tell it, I think you're kind of feeding part of the problem here.
It's much more difficult to achieve justice, if at all. I mean, it's just the fact of the matter. It's so challenging, because at the time, the victims have the most to lose. And depending on if it's a situation at work or wherever, I mean, their careers could be on the line, you know, their reputation, family life. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot that rides on that. But I think it's painfully obvious that, you know, if a woman does a tell, I mean, it's much more difficult later on. There's no recourse. Absolutely. I mean, there just really isn't any.
And there's no way to remain anonymous.
No.
I mean, it's up to everyone to create the type of environment that encourages women to come forward.
And provides the support networks.
Absolutely.
As well, yeah.
But you got to come forward and you got to put your name on it. I think that's the only way we take the Me Too movement to its conclusion. I think there's a lot of people and a lot of women looked at this and said, wait a minute, what has the last 8 months of Me Too gotten me?
Yeah.
I mean, if this just goes down and the Republicans just whip this through, then there's no even investigation or more questioning. That feels like a year's worth of wasted effort, and we've made no progress at all. And I certainly understand why that would be their feeling.
Right. And it's a pivotal moment, I think, for the movement in terms of everything that's happened over the last couple of years. And it's, you know, we're talking about one of the highest positions in the country, most power. And I think that's why this has kind of outsized importance, and everybody's looking to see how you know, this is treated, and that's why we, you know, have to tread cautiously. But I think that at the end of the day, you know, whether he's confirmed or not, there's gonna be much said about the process.
Yeah.
And that's why this was I think so dangerous and so from in terms of the message it was sends to society, that if it was rushed through and these accusations aren't given the weight and seriousness that they deserve, especially after her testimony, because I think after that there was no denying, and the idea that somehow, you know, we're just going to rush through
just
as
make
if
this up and she's right. not just a Democratic operative.
Yeah,
that's not what this is. What did you think of Lindsey Graham's little speech?
You know, I think he was playing a role. The New Yorker magazine had a pretty lengthy article about Lindsey Graham's transformation over the last year as being like a Trump critic.
Which has been significant.
The kind of like Trump lapdog.
Yeah.
And, you know, and trying to understand why and how. And it's a lot of it is just, you know, standard politics and trying to get reelected in South Carolina and fend off a primary challenger. But I think clearly, I mean, I think that this was prepared and rehearsed, and it was, you know, being able to change the narrative and then be able to provide cover to the other Republicans as well to support him and to change it from that this is, you know, a fact-finding mission to this is an attack. It's an attempt to smear somebody's character, and that, you know, the process is too politicized and that we can't trust it. I think that was the intent.
So I get it. Dianne Feinstein did this in a political manner.
I think that definitely hurt the process, the way this was handled, the, you know, sitting on this for several weeks. And then, I mean, the entire way that this rolled out, I think, was detrimental. And I think, you know, and you can argue that it was done for political motives, and I think it was, and, you know, and you have senators that are fundraising off of this, which I think is completely disgusting.
She apologized for that, the gal from Hawaii, but that was wholly inappropriate.
Oh, completely. And then again, it sullies the entire process. And I think it completely damages the reputation of these institutions, the Senate, the Judiciary Committee, the Supreme Court itself, in the long run. But again, all of that notwithstanding, I think that you have to look at that separately from Dr. Ford and her testimony and her experience.
Yes.
Because irreflective of that, Dr. Ford brought these accusations forward. She came forward and struggled with this. And it was clear to me watching that she was bringing this forward completely apolitically. The politics is probably the furthest thing from her.
Yeah.
It was knowing that he was up for this lifetime appointment and that this is a story that needs to be told and needs to be out there.
Nobody puts himself through that for somebody else's political gain.
No, there's nothing to gain.
There's just no
way. I mean, and, you know, and I think it was mentioned that he and his family, Judge Kavanaugh and his family, have received death threats and everything, which is horrible.
Absolutely.
But so has Dr. Ford, and her family has had to move out of their home and are basically transferring residences at every couple of days because they can't stay in one place because of the exposure this has brought.
Lindsey Graham gives this righteous indignation speech. How dare you, Democrats, sully this process? This is a sham. This is the worst thing I've ever seen in my 20-some-odd years in the Senate, and on and on and on. Something that played very well to Republicans.
Republican base voters, to the president, I would imagine.
I ask you this question as a Republican. How, with a straight face, can Lindsey Graham or anybody take seriously what Lindsey Graham said when Mitch McConnell is on the record of saying his proudest moment in politics was Merrick Garland? How can anybody look at that and take any of that righteousness and that how dare you? How can any of that be taken seriously?
I don't know. I think that's a very good question. And I find it interesting that whenever my Democrat friends bring this up, I have Republican friends that immediately say, oh, well, you know, the situation circumstances are different. It was a presidential election year. It was a lame duck president, completely, you know, within, you know, scope of their rights to be able to block the nomination. And it's almost like there's a failure to comprehend the ramifications of that, because this is clearly not the most detrimental thing that has happened within the Judiciary Committee, not at all by far.
Going back to our history. I'm sorry, Merrick Garland? or
well no what happened yesterday. I was talking about Lindsey Graham's righteous indignation.
Yeah, this is absolutely.
I mean, that was a lot of hyperbole.
You expect some of that.
Right.
But my point is that he made the point that I think if you still support, if there are people who still support Brett Kavanaugh who basically agree with Graham that this is about not rewarding Democrats' bad behavior. And that's what this is about. This isn't about trying to get to the truth. This isn't about getting an investigation. This isn't about looking at all of these allegations in totality. This is, I am not going to let Feinstein and the Democrats pull what I feel is a scam over on me.
Well,
over
this seat. You have some Republicans that have said directly that they're appalled by the way Senator Feinstein handled this, and so because of that alone, that it doesn't really matter. The allegations don't matter, and the credibility doesn't, and that he needs to just be confirmed because of the way this was
absolutely
mishandled.
And then him basically threatening, saying, "Wait till it's your turn," basically telling the Democrats, "Wait till it's your next nominee."
Right. Which again, it already was with Merrick Garland.
And you look at him and say, it already was.
Yeah.
His name was Merrick Garland. Mitch McConnell wouldn't give him. And I still have yet to see any logical argument of precedent to say we can hold a seat open for 437 days till we're in, because we're in a presidential election.
I don't think there was precedent for that.
There's not.
And that's they set the precedent, and that's what's dangerous about that. I mean, because it could come back to bite them and likely will at some
point. So now can you just say, well, we're going to hold till the midterms? I mean, where does this stop? And I think that's what Flake started to process. Not only is this personal to these two people, and this is a horrible story, and it's a cultural turning point that we need to that we need to kind of recognize as we're here. What are you doing as, I'm going to say, as Republicans to the Supreme Court? Where are you at? So if he goes on under the Republican watch, you had
and under this cloud, of
Clarence
suspicion.
Thomas, who again, a lot of people asterisk him as. Oh, the person who sexually harassed women at work that the Republicans pencil whipped through. I think that's how most people see him. It's common. Oh. It's a very common story that there were three women who could have corroborated Anita Hill's story that they didn't let testify. Then you've got Merrick Garland, and now this. I think Flake came to the conclusion, or somebody. Maybe huddled up with him, and they got to say, "Listen, we're at the edge of maybe doing some real long term damage to ourselves that we need to avoid."
And to themselves and the institution, to the Supreme Court itself. I think that it hurts the reputation of the court, long term, and knowing that this is how kind of nominees were put forward. So it's. Yeah, I think that overall, and it's damaging to the country. And I think that the repercussions would have been longstanding, much more so than even Clarence Thomas. I think
I agree.
You know, Thomas has that asterisk by his name. I don't think it's hurt his effectiveness at all. And I think long term, the court has, been somewhat mitigated reputationally. Yeah. It hasn't had an impact.
One.
But I think this would. I think, and especially in the context of the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
And as soon as you had any class action lawsuit or any case involving women's rights or
absolutely.
Equal pay or anything like that come before
it's
the court,
be an issue.
Oh, it would immediately be an issue.
So now let's go to Kavanaugh. So Kavanaugh appeared on Fox News. He was measured. He was under control. He was what you would think a federal appeals judge would be.
Right. But apparently Trump was not happy with his performance on that Fox News.
Universally ripped apart.
Right.
So now we get to Thursday, and here it comes. I mean, he just explodes into his opening statement, and it's on from there. I literally watched that saying, I don't know what this is. I was not ready for the emotional outpour. I wasn't ready for how he presented himself.
Right.
I wasn't ready for his basically attacking of the senators that asked him questions. You talked about you went back and rewatched Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas didn't yell at anybody.
Thomas, very measured, calm
tone.
He didn't
turn questions back at the senators.
That was what was most
startling
to me.
Cringy moments in that.
I mean, you know, asking the senators, do you drink? I mean, and, you know.
When was the last time you blacked out drunk?
Well, and the problem was, and by doing that, he never answered the questions they asked him. He was evasive. So it was that technique. I thought it was also interesting. He borrowed some of Clarence Thomas's language verbatim. He called it what was happening to him a national disgrace, which was the terms that Clarence Thomas used. He didn't say high-tech lynching, but he used similar language.
Like a seek and destroy mission.
Yeah,
stuff
and then
like that.
And then he totally politicized it by saying it was, you know, Clinton, the Clintons were involved.
Where
in
did
this,
that come from?
And that there was this left-wing conspiracy.
That had to be a line just for Trump.
I think
it
so.
It had to be.
But again, it does reputational damage to the court, because if he does get on the court, I mean, he is supposed to be non-biased and measured and apolitical. And here he is in this political rant. And, you know, again, the court loses credibility, and he does in that case. Now, I do think he was hurt felt when he talked about his family and when he talked about himself.
I agree.
And I feel like he came across sincere and credible in that. And I think that's not knowing, not being able to say exactly what happened, if something happened. And that's the whole takeaway from this. If he did do this, I think he could have very well, maybe he thinks he did it or did it, but if he was blackout drunk, that he doesn't remember.
So the one thing he never really answered was some of his drinking habits question.
Yeah.
Have you ever drunk to the point that you've passed out? Have you ever blacked out? Have you ever not remembered anything? He really gave no answers to any of those questions.
And this idea, I mean, painting him as this kind of like all-American boy, like, you know, this...
Yeah.
It wasn't very credible. I mean, it was obvious that he and his friends are, you know, social network. They went to parties. They drank a lot. You know,
they drank a lot.
They went to beach houses. You know, and what do you do when you go to a beach house in high school? I mean, come on.
And I think too that this is his. Then he said, "Yes, I drank beer. I was 18." Didn't come out and say, "Have I struggled with alcohol in the past?" Yeah, I'll admit it. Through high school and college, I drank way too much.
Well, and his best friend, I mean, is a recovering alcoholic.
Well, have you read any of that stuff on, was it Mark Judge?
Oh, his book?
Some of the comments he's made about women, some of the things that were written like in his yearbook
here and there.
And other stuff.
Yeah.
Women are like a gong. They need to be consistently beaten. I mean, it's not a good look for him.
Yeah.
So one of the things is I left that thinking that man in no way, shape, or form looked, acted, or performed as I would expect a Supreme Court judge in any three of those areas.
Right. I do want to clarify, I do think that people can engage in youthful discretions and drink to excess and be party, and they can grow out of that. Again, this is an aside, not relating to the allegations. Damn. And so I would hesitate to, you know, hold somebody, you know, to character for their party behavior.
I agree.
But at the same time, he should have owned up to it. I think the fact that he didn't own up to it, and in fact, tried to paint himself the other way. You go back to the virginity claims that he was a virgin, you know, through like college and all this. I think that if he would have just owned up and said, yeah, we were kids, we did irresponsible things, we partied, but he's like, you know, that was common back then. And he's like, I've grown out of that. And obviously you see where I'm now.
At
all. But there is a feeling that he never really owned up to any of that. You know, it was all about, oh, you know, I played sports and I cared about academics.
I was number one in my class.
Yeah.
I went to church. Yeah. I think Americans can forgive anything, and Americans love an underdog, and we love the second chance story.
Yes.
Kavanaugh had an opportunity there to say, you know, yes, I've made some mistakes. I have struggled from time to time with this, and this is how I've got past it, and this is how I've changed. And the only thing I can tell you about Dr. Ford is four people who she said were at that have all signed statements saying they weren't there and it didn't happen. And I really can't say any more than that. And I think if he just would have come out with, I saw no sincerity at all in his presentation. It's almost like he put on a tape, or his lawyer put on a tape of Trump and said, this is your audience. This is what he wants to see. He wants to see you go at these people at a personal level, and he's got to see you as a fighter. Therefore, that's the character you have to play. And I got to be honest, I thought it came off horrible.
Yeah, I was a little bit more conflicted on it. I think there were bits and pieces where he came across as credible and sincere, and then there were other times where he wasn't. And I think that was what was a little bit concerning, is he vacillated between, you know, seemingly being distraught and upset and then being angry and defiant. And it was this kind of back and forth demeanor, you know, throughout. And then being just kind of openly hostile to many of the senators and his questioning.
The exchange
that
he had with the Minnesota Senator Klobuchar.
Klobuchar,
am I saying that right? God, I have no English again tonight. That was disgraceful.
Yeah,
I don't know what that was.
I thought that was awful because, I mean, her questions were very respectful, and I thought that she was very measured. And
you saw the struggle she had even when it turned to her father.
Yeah.
I mean, you saw in her face, in her body language changed. I mean, he came off as a man with no empathy at all.
And yeah,
I'll say this. I said this while we were kind of, you know, warming up. The only thing I thought of when I watched Brett Kavanaugh is, wow, that's a mean drunk. Picture that dude with six beers in him. And what does he look like then?
Yeah. It makes you wonder. And again, it was a complete missed opportunity to just own up to what has you know, many already think that he did drink and he liked to party and he drank to excess. And if he can't own up to that and just and humanize himself in that way, and he wasn't able to do that. And so I think that was missed. You know, he took great care not to impugn Dr. Ford or to cast aspersions on her character or what happened to her. You know, which again, I think he had to. I think obviously that would not have played at all. I think the defiance was to an audience of one, but it did it play to the audience of millions, I think, watching. I think other than the president and his base voters who want to see that type of attack and, you know, defense.
So let's talk about what's happening now. So, you know, we've talked about Flake and Collins and Murkowski. They've kind of forced McConnell into this 7-day FBI investigation. So let's kind of think about what's going to happen in this 7 days. What are the odds you think more accusers come forward in the next 7 days?
I mean, I think the odds are fairly good now because it's
about 70%.
The timeline has been extended. And so I think that you will see that. And I will say this, if the FBI investigation adds more clarity to the situation that supports the claims against Kavanaugh, you know, I think that increases the likelihood that this is drawn out or the nomination doesn't happen. If we don't get anything additionally, if we don't get any additional clarity, then I don't see how it prevents his nomination.
Do you think
so? That's really where we're at.
Do you think any side on this is going to end up happy?
No. I don't see it all. And I think there's lasting damage. And we're not gonna have this resolved. We're not gonna know definitively what happened. And so we're going to be left with bits and pieces and trying to make truth out of that and seeing what is more likely. Yeah. But it won't be definitive. And I think that, and this goes back to the very beginning, the way that was handled, you know, and I place the blame on both the Democrats and the Republicans for how this has been politicized. But I don't think coming out of this that there's anything to be proud of or any kind of moment where we can say, hey, we've moved forward and we actually accomplished something.
That's a great point. There's nothing here, folks, to be proud of.
No.
If my side washes out Kavanaugh, don't take a victory lap, because the price we paid to do this might be something that we regret down the field.
Well, and I wrote a long extended Facebook post on this, and
you did. A lot of people at least when I read it early in the morning, people were liking it. Did they turn on you later in the day, or was it pretty positive?
No, it was pretty positive. There were a few people there. I got some, and my Facebook friends are pretty balanced between Republicans, Democrats, conservative, liberal.
You're accused of being a rhino. You're not really Republican. You're not really conservative. Right, yada, right. Yada, yada.
That's what happens. You think independently. But it was pretty pretty supportive, and I was just surprised by the positive feedback and the number of shares and people that liked it and agreed. It was a novel, which, you know, and so you have to really read it.
That was long.
But one of the items I highlight was the fact that, you know, it felt like political theater, because there was so much of the talk was on who performed the best and whether or not this was a draw. And again, I think we lose sight of the fact that these were very serious allegations and that there are no winners and losers that come out of this. The only loser is, you know, our nation. attention in terms of what was on display. And so I think that's what's unfortunate. I think that this could be a moment to where we could move forward and say this is defining in terms of how we handle these types of allegations. I don't think it was.
Well,
I think it was overly politicized to the fact that it doesn't move the needle. It's just been used as a political pawn, and that's basically all that's
however
happening
this
with
is. We're both retreating back to our corners,
right?
With more scarred up, more battle ready, and more determined at the next fight, we've got to win at all costs.
And once again, the problem is that people basically regressed into political tribalism, right? So basically, there were people on the right that did give Dr. Ford the time of day because, you know, this was their guy.
Same way,
completely
people
closed
left.
Their minds. And same way on the left, you know, some of whom just see him as what they say is a serial, you know. Well,
as he said, he talked about, you know, some people here have called me evil. Senator Spartacus from New Jersey called him evil even prior to his
which is outrageous.
Is ridiculous.
I mean, it poisons the well. It's all of it poisons the well. And you wonder why we have the vitriol and the discourse we have in America, and you have death threats, and you have both of these people whose lives have been changed upside down. It's that type of rhetoric.
A conversation with somebody at work today. Hey, Kavanaugh is a type of judge. Let's take his personal stuff completely off the table and just look at his record. That's the kind of judge Republican-controlled Senate and presidents nominate.
Right.
There's nothing really that off about Kavanaugh as a justice. I don't. He said Roe versus Wade is settled law. He is not going to reverse Roe. They're going to chip away at it. They're going to make it harder and harder to get an abortion.
Right.
Like in the state of Kansas, it's next to impossible. They'll make it even more so. But he's not going to overturn Roe.
And this
is the consequence of, if you're on my side, Republicans winning all three branches of government. This is what you get. There's no difference here. There's no difference really between, I don't think, him and Gorsuch from a
ideological.
Being a judge, from an ideological. If he washes out, guess what's going to happen?
Yeah, because he is probably the most nuanced out of nominees considered. So you're just going to get someone who's down
again,
the line
I'm taking
ideological.
All of the personal stuff and all the allegations off the table. That's not what this is about. From a straight jurist perspective, be careful, Dems, what you wish for. Because if Roe v. Wade is your hot button, let me tell you, we wash Kavanaugh out. The next one coming down the pike is probably going to be even more of a danger to that decision.
Well, and Craig, you and I have talked about this. I mean, the court has become politicized and has been since the 90s. That's why all of the 5-4 decisions. The court wasn't like this. If you go back to the 60s, 70s, you know, and beyond, we would have justices that were appointed by presidents that you cannot determine how they would rule on any given issue because they were fairly independent and they weren't ideologues. We no longer have that because each side is focused on political wins, and so they ensured that they get the most politically pure person nominated. Same happens on the Democrat side, so you rarely see any deviation. Same on the Republican side. You don't have any more Kennedys or O'Connors. I mean,
those
days are
gone. We're not going to.
Yeah.
After this shit show, that's not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
Is all of this about abortion?
I think
really
most of it goes back.
This is about?
Typically, that's the issue. That is a defining issue for both the left and the right, and that is the core issue that both sides are concerned about. That's what drove Trump to the presidency. Really, was Supreme Court nomination.
The Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And the biggest issue in Supreme Court are guns, which I think that's a settled. We're not going to repeal the Second Amendment.
No, that's
we're
not going to happen.
We're not going to restrict guns in any significant way. It's a fantasy. That people have. But if after the last 2 years we haven't been moved to action, we're not going to act. So is this all we have left to fight about? Is abortion? And I guess this is the rock we're willing to die on?
It is. I mean, because both sides, I guess, still see that as the way to impact. If you look at kind of the states, a lot of the states have chipped away at abortion the last several years. And there's really been like this state by state dichotomy that's emerged with, you know, various regulations. And so both sides see the court as a way to either reverse that or, you know, move it back.
There's a great Netflix documentary I watched called Overturning Roe. And it's the history of Roe v. Wade, how it got passed, and then kind of what is the current state of abortion as told by a doctor out of St. Louis who literally spends her entire week flying to different Midwestern clinics and facilities because she's one of only a handful of doctors in this part of the country that will still perform an abortion. And I think, again, people think there's like abortion clinics and in every city, and they're fairly common. In Kansas, in Missouri, we're down to, I think Kansas has one. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there may be two. I think there's here in Johnson County, there's one, and there's one in Wichita.
But I thought there was one in Wichita.
There's one in Wichita, but there's Planned Parenthood, I think, here in Overland Park.
And Missouri is down to very, very few.
I think Missouri is down to one, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, again, what most people, if you feel that abortion is rampant, there are certain parts of the country where it's nearly impossible to get an abortion.
Yeah, the problem with which this is basically the last issue I wanted to discuss.
Let's get off this quickly.
Because this is such a lightning rod issue and people have such strong opinions about it.
Mike would literally physically just lock up and wouldn't talk anymore.
And the problem is people have such strong opinions about this issue. But I will say that most people when it comes to the abortion issue are in the middle. They are not far left, far right.
Absolutely.
Most people are uneasy with it. They want common ground. They want some basic regulations, but they want it available. They want, you know, it's not all or nothing. But unfortunately, what dominates the debate are the both sides, far left, far right, that want all or nothing. And so it's a lightning rod for them and for everything, policy level, when it comes to elections, when it comes to the court.
So I think it's still more than 55% Kavanaugh gets approved.
Yeah. I mean, again,
you want to go 60-40? Or is that too high or too low?
No, I think that's fair. I think, 55-45.
Let's say it's 55-45
that
he goes. Scenario is Kavanaugh gets approved. What impact does it have to the Dems? What impact does that have to the Republicans in the midterms?
You know, it's interesting because Republicans, the common commentary was that Republicans were going to lose a lot of base turnout if they didn't approve him. And so the flip side of that is the belief that somehow they're going to get that turnout now by approving him. But it, you know, I wonder at the same time how galvanizing it will be, because it's already a done deal. You know, is that really going to galvanize them to come out once the votes are there? It's like, well, it's happened. I mean, it's not as incentive as it would be if it didn't happen, or if it was, you know, hanging, you know.
Well, I saw some polling that Kavanaugh is the least popular Supreme Court nominee.
I saw that as well.
Ever. With independents, with Republicans, with Democrats.
This definitely galvanizes the board. Left, though.
Oh, yeah.
Completely. I mean, this is just, and again, we've talked about this, a year of the woman. I mean, this is just another layer to what's already happening into that.
So I think if I were a Republican 2020 strategist and Trump hired me, which one I would never take the job because he'd never pay me on time, probably. what I would tell him is, Mr. President, you're about to win a battle, but you're about to lose a war. The third rail that got you here was suburban white educated women. They're already evaporated.
Right.
If Kavanaugh gets on, you've energized them even more now in a way that not only is all of that going to evaporate. And remember, sir, you only won three upper Midwestern states by like under 150,000 votes. It was the thinnest of thin of margins that put you here. And what really won this for you are suburban white women in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, and Wisconsin. If you kick that support out, you have no path. You need to think about what the Kavanaugh, if he gets approved, what that does to you. I'm under the impression that it basically sinks Trump in 2020. There's no way.
Yeah, I think it's lasting damage. It becomes a rallying cry against him. You know, and the fact is, the president likes to brag about winning women, although he always uses the incorrect number. I think at a rally a week ago, he said that he won 52% of the women's vote.
He did not.
He neglected to say that was 52% of white married women.
Yes.
If you look at women as a whole, including minorities, he did not win.
There are women of color.
Apparently not in his.
I know you don't see a world. Lot of them, and you don't. They're not in your orbit. But the things that are going to sink you in 2020 are college educated white women and African American women.
Yeah. And I don't know, again, I think he, I don't know that he's smart enough to realize that or is, will listen, you know, to if he, that is the advice he gets. I think that he is just going to kind of dig in. That's his tendency. You know, he just digs in. It's very rare for him to reverse course or to change his mind. I mean, it takes a lot. I mean, the fact that the White House has called for the FBI investigation is extremely unusual because I
think that's a sign Trump's willing to wash him out.
That may be.
I think that's a sign Trump's willing to say, well, hey, I'm finally recognizing that I may be hurting my party, myself, and maybe this isn't the best way to go.
And, you know, there was a lot of discussion that Kavanaugh's performance at the hearing was going to determine that as well, that Trump was watching intently to see how he performed, because then he was going to just, you know, cut him loose.
Maybe somebody got to Trump and said, hey, I know you think that was a positive.
Right.
That had a lot of bad, bad, bad parts in it. So right in the middle of all of this, you know, you're trying to work, you're trying to process this, you know, I've got like Fox in one browser. I got MSNBC in the other, you know, I'm trying to balance coverage off. The phone goes off and it's Ron Rosenstein headed to the White House, expects to be fired. And it's like, holy shit. You mean to tell me in the middle? This was when Trump was at the UN.
Yeah, before that was canceled. Yeah,
I mean, this could be a 3-hour podcast this week. We haven't even talked about Trump getting laughed at the UN.
Oh, I know, right?
That rambling press conference he gave, and I'll just say it again.
Didn't hear the White House line? They were laughing with him.
Well, I'll say it again. I guess at this point, being incoherent and in the inability to put two words together to form a sentence without lying, that's just something we don't expect of the American president anymore.
No.
Okay. So be it. That is what it is.
I do think it was telling that Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, gave a rebuttal speech to Trump's, you know, isolationist speech. Yeah. Which, if you get a chance to check it out, what Western democracy and the NATO alliance is supposed to be about. And then the other interesting thing was that President Trump avoided Justin Trudeau at every turn at the UN. I mean,
because I guess they're our number one importer of steel, I believe.
I think that's
it's
correct.
One or two. Apparently, we're not going to do business with them anymore over milk. So if the tariffs were about national security, how does dairy fit into this? I think Canada and Trudeau finally threw up their hands and said, we're done.
Yeah.
We're done. We're out. We're not. We'll sit. We'll wait. This will change. We'll get back to you when it does.
There are two small other items that I just wanted to highlight that I thought were kind of interesting. So we were talking about Senator Flake earlier. I believe, has a trip to New Hampshire scheduled. Upcoming.
Really?
Yeah, I think St. Anselm College. He's giving a speech. It'll be his second visit to New Hampshire.
I've always thought he's going to primary Trump.
Right.
I think he's going to.
Well, and for the first time, he didn't rule that out. He said he hasn't decided one way or the other, which, again, is very telling.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no denial. And then for all of those who, you know, bemoan that, you know, our politics and how it's devolving, I think there was nothing that epitomized that greater than there's an Arizona congressional race where the incumbent congressman's brothers and sisters actually came out in a TV ad against him, which is just, I think, unprecedented. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it.
Did you watch that ad?
I did, yeah.
Brutal. Oh. That's a bad Thanksgiving at that house.
Can you imagine?
I totally forgot about that. But my wife is like, have you seen this?
I believe it's Congressman Paul Gosar, if I'm saying that right, in Arizona.
He's one of six.
Yeah.
And like all five of his brothers and sisters who look like they're pretty big swath of age range as six children would be. That was one of the most merciless things I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. Difficult.
We need to do some research, because what's wrong with that guy that five of your siblings would come out and basically tell America? I took that as saying this guy's the biggest asshole in the United States.
Yeah, I'd have to do more. I know that he's a huge Trump supporter. He's very nationalist, has that, you know, rhetoric, kind of feeds into the xenophobia, into the, you know, anti-immigration. So I think that had to do with it. From what I've heard, his siblings have said what you kind of said, that he's basically kind of a jerk and has been for a long time. But that takes it to a whole new level. Were you appearing in a campaign ad against your
brother? I saw like a headline of that, and I didn't click on it because I'm like, oh, that's clickbait. That's nothing. And then later my wife's like, have you watched this? And it's like, oh, that's really bad. Yeah,
I don't see any like family gatherings with all of them anytime
Christmas
soon.
Christmas is off.
Yeah, that's
no
done.
One's coming to Thanksgiving. Oh. Or at least he ain't. How could you vote for a guy whose five brothers and sisters come out and say, I wouldn't do it?
Yeah, I don't know. Although that's a pretty safe Republican district. That's not in the lean or toss-up column by 538 or Cook Political Report. So I don't know that moves the needle. But the race has a lot of exposure and attention now. I mean, that's... Well,
this week reminded me, what's the one thing we didn't need right now? We didn't need a nasty, partisan, no-holds-barred, bare-knuckle political fight.
Yeah.
And that's exactly we got.
Yep.
With no end in sight. And when this, whatever conclusion this meets, then we have the midterms. Then we have, I think, the wrap-up of the Mueller investigation. I think the Mueller investigation, and Comey came out with a tweet, and he's no good source of data, but he's like, hey, Mueller's in the fourth quarter, and I believe that. He's got all the pieces.
Yeah.
This is going to be just strap in, because for now till the end of the year, it's just, I think this is the pace we're going to be on.
Yeah, it's completely different times politically, and and as for terms of tone and nastiness, I mean, I think, you know, it's just going to get worse. We're not going to see less.
What would be worse? I mean, people always talk about 1968. If you Google years that it was almost years that we didn't know the United States was going to make through. And whenever you think that today is bad, Google 1968.
That's true. We don't
Martin
have riots
Luther King,
yet.
The Kennedy assassination and the Democratic Convention riots in Chicago. A lot of people said, if you think this is bad, and this is bad, you can look back not too many years and see it can get a whole lot worse.
It can. And that's what I think I have concern over, because the environment and the rhetoric is so toxic that all it takes is one person or somebody who's deranged or unhinged to bubble up and do something, you know, and that's a scary thought. And again, we've come close to that already several instances. So
let the Democrats somehow win the House and the Senate. I think they win the House. I don't. They 538 said they had about a 1/3 shot of winning the Senate. That's probably right.
Yeah.
Let that go down though, and watch Trump just absolutely lose his shit.
Oh well,
everybody's fired.
I don't. Did we talk about a couple weeks ago when Trump said that there will be violence?
Oh yeah.
If the Democrats win, which I was just like, what? Like again?
And once again, that's just normal. That's just normal behavior.
I know. We just shrug and move on.
What I really want to know is how many of these rules are going to apply to the next president. It's going to be really interesting to say, do we just etch a sketch this whole experience, just shake it and wash it away?
I hope so. I mean, you don't want...
All right. We're carrying none of that forward. You're back to the normal rules of play.
You have to go back to normal rules. I mean, you can't sustain this.
That's right. We're not going to allow you
democracy,
to stand here and just lie constantly. You know, that's just not going to be tolerated.
Right. You can't have those as new norms. We have to go back to the old ones.
Trump, you know, 6-week, 8-week debate schedule would be awesome.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Because they're such polar opposites. That would be kind of fun to watch.
That would be incredible. Yeah.
Well, we'll probably try to do this Thursday or Friday again next week so we get another full week to try to get some type of view of what's happening in the country.
Yeah, it definitely was worthwhile to do it this week with everything that transpired.
And Mueller, I don't care if you have like a signed indictment for the president. Not next week. We all need a break. We need to come down off this.
We do.
We got to plant some downtime before we go.
I agree completely. Yeah.
That's our hour. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Craig.